Well, it's wonderful to be back with you 5 minutes later, and I am here with Nirmala. I had said Nirmala maybe or something like that. I've already forgotten, but he said it sounds like Pamela, Nirmala. So, Nirmala, would you like to say hi to everyone?
Hi, everybody. Really nice to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here, too. Now, I think that there are definitely people in the room who know who you are. And in fact, I think that Lynn Johnson, who is our sanctuary director, she has even maybe played some of your videos or audios in the room since in the last week or so, so that people could get to know you. But I think there are probably also people here who don't know you. So maybe we should kind of start at the beginning with the traditional story that will give people a little bit of an idea of your experience and how you came to this point of sitting here speaking with us today.
Okay, let's see how far back do you want me to go?
Yeah, well, that's up to you. I'll leave it up to you. We don't want to spend an hour and a half with story, just enough to give people some frame of reference.
So, things really heated up for me about 20 years ago when my first marriage ended kind of suddenly from my perspective, when my wife fell in love with another man. And I was, at the time I was in the middle of naturopathic medical school. And, was just not, didn't see that coming at all, and was kind of, actually the thing that made it difficult was it wasn't just the emotions. It was the intensity of the emotions and the fact that there were all these equal and opposite emotions. It sounds kind of crazy, but, if for a marriage like that to end, there must have been some things that weren't so great happening in the marriage. And we've been married for 13 years. And so when I found out she was leaving me, there was this, incredible sadness, sense of loss, grief, and, almost, again, equal intensity, a tremendous sense of relief and excitement. Like, oh, well, gee, now what could life be about, if it's not about this marriage that has its difficult parts? And so, but I just couldn't contain all that emotion. And so I started looking for something to help. And the thing I stumbled upon was the Sedona method. And it's almost perfect because it's really all about just, kind of releasing emotions or letting them be here. And so I sent away for a course, did a video course on my own for a week when I had a break between semesters. And I went from, in that 1 week, I went from feeling, probably like the worst I'd ever felt in my life to feeling the best I'd ever felt in my life. There was such a profound sense of release, of relief, of letting go. And at one point during that course, I did an exercise and it suggested like after you get good at letting go of the not so positive emotions like fear and anger and things like that, they said, go ahead and let go of the acceptance and peace that show up. So I was out for a walk and I did that. I just kept letting go, whatever came up, whatever good feeling came up. I just kept letting go, letting go, letting go. And it got just incredibly quiet inside. And it was so remarkable, such a beautiful thing. I was out in nature walking and the birds singing, but I was so quiet inside that I could hear all of that. I could experience it all in a fresh way. So I went right home, called them up because I had seen somewhere that they were offering an advanced Sedona method retreat in a few weeks. And I called them up and said, I'm just a beginner, but can I come to this advanced retreat? And Hale Dwoskin, who ran the retreat, said, yeah, sure, come on. So I went up there kind of thinking I was going to some sort of like advanced stress release, stress relief kind of program. That's all, the only context I really had for it was it seemed to help me in a stressful time. And I got there and I found out that really the heart of the Sedona method is all about spiritual awakening. And that especially the people who were there were all there. They'd been long-term people who had been trying for years to awaken. And finally, one of their own had made it, and she was helping lead the retreat, and that was Pamela Wilson. And so I got there, and it's this, like, room full of people who are all these heavy-duty spiritual seekers, and then there's me, who just, found this thing a few weeks ago. And, but I, you know, I went with it, and, at a certain point, I realized I didn't want to end up like them. I wanted to just go straight to spiritual freedom, you know, straight to awakening. I didn't want to end up, you know, spending decades in a room trying to awaken. And so, I thought I would, in fact, Hale had given this list of wants. And it said at a certain point you let go, it's kind of like letting go of all the feelings. He says at a certain point you even let go of the desire for freedom. And so in the middle of the night one night, I had this bright idea. You know, I was just laying in my bed, and I had this bright idea that, oh, I know, I'll just go to the final step. I'll just let go of the desire for freedom. But I didn't know if it would really work. and so I thought, well, I'll ask Hale in the morning, you know, I'll ask him when I get back to class. But then I realized right then in the night that Hale never answered any questions. He would just do the Sedona method arm people until they got their own answer. Hmm. So I said, well, I'll just figure it out for myself. So I just got real quiet inside and just asked, can I go straight to freedom? And the answer that came, that it was just a certainty, a knowing, was, it's not up to you. And the devastating thing was, in that exact same moment, I realized that it was too late. I was already like all the other people in the room. That actually, especially after having met Pamela, and also that week I met the woman that became my teacher, Neelam, I realized that I wanted whatever it was they had. And I wanted it more than life itself. And then I had this sudden realization that it wasn't up to me. There wasn't anything I specifically could do to make it happen. And that was such a intensely devastating realization, those two things together, that I wanted it and there's nothing I could do, that I just started wailing. Middle of the night, my poor, you know, the people in the nearby rooms, because I was just wailing, and something in me just kind of broke open, and I knew that that's what my life was about, even though there was nothing I could do about it. It also wasn't something I could put aside.
Right.
And so it turned out that week that Neelam was in Sedona giving satsang. I'd never even heard of satsang. And and everybody from the retreat was all, every night we would all pile into cars and go to this thing called satsang. And it was, again, even more so than with Pamela, there was just something about her presence that, I couldn't wrap my mind around it. I couldn't get a hold of it. All I knew was that it was something incredibly attractive, incredibly powerful. And at the same time, it was also like seeing it up close. It was human. It was something that you could experience as a human being. Neelam was not, you know, any different really than any other person. So, to make a longer story short, I went back to another retreat with Neelam, and she was going, at that time she was going to India for several months. And so even though India was like the last place on the planet that I wanted to go, I never thought about going. I mean, at the time I remember saying to my friends, I said, why can't she be going to Italy? Why can't we go have satsang in Italy? You know, I always wanted to go to Italy. But no, she was going to India. So at a certain point I just knew I was going. And so and by the way, this part isn't really important. It's just the way it happened in my case, you know, but I literally gave all of the equity in this house we had just bought to my soon-to-be ex-wife, so that she would move back in and pay the mortgage. I dropped out of medical school, and I followed Neelam to India, through Europe first, and then on to India.
Did you get to go to Italy?
No, just London and Amsterdam.
Okay.
And as I was going, you know, that thing that Hale had talked about, letting go of the desire for freedom, it just started happening. I have no, you know, real explanation except that I just kept getting happier and happier. It didn't matter to me anymore I was at the time I was running the sound system for Neelam. If I ended up doing that for the rest of my life, that would have been fine. It was so simple. I just kept getting happier and happier. And we did make it to India. We made it to Rishikesh. We're in this beautiful ashram, right, where this other river comes into the Ganges. And we were doing satsang, a couple times a day, bhajans or chanting, almost every day. And just India itself is such an intense experience. And then I got in the habit when everyone else went to bed, I would just go down to the river and I would sit. There was this stretch of the river right there that was this massive set of rapids. So I would go sit like 2 feet away from the water's edge, and the river was like this incredible roaring presence, just power 2 feet away. And so I would just sit there for hours at night. And this one night I was sitting there and I just noticed that the rock that I was leaning against was actually me. It was very simple, very obviously, it was like it was inside of me. Whatever me was, it encompassed the body and this rock. And then, that was a different experience, a different way of experiencing a rock. But then it seemed like, if it's this rock, it wasn't logical, it was just like a knowing that came. It's not just this rock, it's this whole field of boulders on the side of the river. And then, those are inside of me too. And then, if it's the boulders on this side of the river, it's the boulders on the other side of the river. It was kind of logical like that, but it was more experiential. It was more just that suddenly it included the boulders on the other side of the river. Then, of course, that meant it included the river. And then it included the entire Ganges, I don't know how many miles long the Ganges is, but the entire length of India was inside of me. And then it was the whole world. And then it was the solar system. And then it was everything, the universe. My mind, it was quickly getting to a place where my mind, it was, like I said, totally wasn't logical. My mind even couldn't keep up with that. But it was just this knowing that was me. And then it did this very strange thing. It had already expanded to include everything. But then it also expanded, it like popped. And in that moment, it expanded to include all time. And so there was this very direct, visceral recognition that that's what I am, that's what I've always been, that's what I'll always be. And at that moment, I started literally rolling around in the gravel on the side of the river, laughing my head off, because it suddenly seemed so funny, so like hilarious to me that I had ever thought that I had suffered. it didn't compute anymore. How could I have ever suffered? It was just like this fun joke that that consciousness played within itself. And so I just, that whole series of realizations just kind of broke me open, undid something inside of me. It never reformed in its old fashion. There are still structures of personality and so forth, but they don't have any hold on me. I've somehow made it back to the ashram from the river that night, though I remember I had to stop and hug a lot of rocks on the way. and then just gradually after that time, people started asking me, they started just wanting to talk to me. The other people on the trip, I went to some retreats with Neelam after that and back in the United States, and everywhere I went, people sensed something and wanted to talk to me, wanted to ask me questions. And at a certain point, I actually went to Neelam, and I said, Neelam, you know, I told her what was happening, and I said, you know, am I supposed to give satsang? How do you give satsang? You know, I don't see you doing anything. It just happens. But I had this thought, maybe I'm supposed to give satsang. And Neelam always gave really good advice. And her advice was, don't give it another thought. If it's meant to happen, there's nothing you can do to stop it. If it's not meant to happen, there's nothing you can do to make it happen. So she, I'm basically kind of lazy. So,
so you accepted that eagerly then.
Yeah, I could go with that. I was like, oh, forget about it. All right, I can do that. And then literally the very next day, one of the people that had been on a trip with us in India came up to me and said, hey, Nirmala, how would you like to come to my house in Seattle and give satsang? So I said, yes. And inside my head, I thought, oh, that's how it happens. Mm-hmm. And that is really literally how it has happened for many years. I'm not actually giving group satsangs anymore. But it's when I'm asked. And if I ever try, it's funny, I mean, Neelam's words turned out to be prophetic. If I ever tried to make something happen, one happened. If I just followed the invitations, followed the indications, the breadcrumbs, then it would come together. It would happen.
Well, we appreciate your yes to come tonight. That's very sweet.
Yeah.
It's always fun to receive a yes.
Yeah.
So I do have a few questions, and unless you have more to share from the story.
No, that's it. You know, there's a lot more that's unfolded since then, but that's usually the part people want to hear about, because that's how the ball got rolling.
Well, I am going to want to hear a little bit more about what unfolded next. Sure. In fact, I think that's probably where some of my questions maybe are going to point, depending on your experience. But
sure.
You know, like, we know that thinking is a huge distraction. We know that when we're totally lost in our thoughts, and, you know, like you mentioned how you got to where you were walking and you could hear the birds and stuff because you weren't so caught in your thinking. So we know that thinking is a huge distraction. So I was wondering what your experience is with thinking since the night at the river, and how has that changed?
Yeah. I would say that the biggest change, like before that experience to after, it's funny because my experience isn't that thinking has ever stopped. I always joke that I was cursed with a good mind. And so it just likes to do that thing, you know, called figure things out and think and da da da. You know, it just does that thing. And it's a funny way to put it, but I would say I just enjoy it more. You know, it's like I don't take it seriously. It's kind of like a sweet old, relative that you just love them to pieces, and sometimes they don't make any sense, but that's okay because you still love them. There's nothing wrong or right about thinking. It's just thinking. And, you know, another way I speak about it is that I always say that all there is truth. Right? All there is truth. That's what is. That's what everything's made of. That's, you know, you can't experience something other than truth. But the truth, what you can experience is that the truth comes in all different sizes. Big, small, ginormous, you know, tiny, tiny, tiny. There's all different sizes of truth. And it just turns out that thought is a very, very small container for truth. It's not good or bad. It's just really small. And so it's never really that satisfying. It, you know, every now and then, even the mind gets something, kind of gets something right.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I knew that. See, I told you so. I got that one. You know, I figured that out, you know. And of course, that's extremely rare, you know, because the thoughts are so small, you know, that what actually happens most of the time looks nothing like what you thought would happen. Most of the time your thoughts are or even if they're right, they're not. It doesn't even matter that they're right, because it's just one little piece of what actually happened. But still, they do have their place. They have their value. You know, it's a form of thought to know how to cook an omelet or change a flat tire.
Yes.
It doesn't require a lot of mental chatter or that kind of thing. But like I said, when that's present, I'm curious about it. I enjoy it. It's also wonderful when there is that silence. So it's like thought just doesn't matter that much.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you correctly, then there is, of course, you know, what we would call the practical thought, and of course the practical thought is there, but then you do also still experience the chatter, you just don't give it a lot of meaning.
Yeah. It's like it has its, you know, even that has its place. It's like a form of, you know, portable entertainment. who needs an iPhone with a video app if you got a brain? You know, you can just play some silly old movie in your head, and you know, it's the plots are as bizarre as anything that Hollywood makes.
Now, what about people who experience suffering because of their thinking and their relationship with their thinking? Is there anything that you would recommend? Because, like, you're talking about a very you know, detached way of looking at thinking. But as you know, there are people who are very caught up in that thinking, and they really suffer because they believe what the thoughts are saying, especially about them sometimes, and it's very horrible. What would you recommend for them?
You know, obviously, if you can, especially if it's a thought that's creating suffering. I mean, if you are suffering and you can just stop, you know, if you can just cancel, da, 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 and you just stop that, you know, then that's great. That's like probably the most direct route. If not, then I invite people to go the other direction.
Right.
Go right into that experience of suffering. Find out what's really true about it. Is what hurts? Do the sensations that are present, does the experience that you're actually having hurt? Or is it the thoughts that hurt? You know, find out which one really is the source of the so-called suffering. And of course, if you find out that it's the thought that hurts, well, how real is that? How important is that? It is just a thought.
Yeah.
And so I often say that suffering is a mirage. Suffering is a mirage. When you get right up to it, when you don't turn away from it, when you look right at it, you find out there's nothing really there. There's some thoughts, there's some sensations, but there's no actual thing called suffering. Another little trick that can really quickly bring you to it kind of goes back to what I was talking about way at the beginning of these equal and opposite experiences. My experience is that is the nature of thought and emotion and desire, that we have equal and opposite versions of all those things, all the time. So if there's suffering, this may seem really surprising to our usual way of looking at things, but if there's suffering, there's also something present that's enjoying. The way you can sometimes catch it is if you catch how much you enjoy telling the story of your suffering.
Yeah, I did that. I know exactly what you're talking about. That's how I caught it. I caught myself telling the story.
Yeah. And you hear it in people's voice. You know, they'll go, "Oh my God, you won't believe what happened to me." And they're like excited to be able to tell this story of suffering because it's so dramatic and so intense, and some part of them was just like enjoying it while they were miserable, you know, because they knew they would get to tell the story later, you know. But even if it's happening right now and you get to tell the story, then you're suddenly, it's like, oh, that little bit of that strange kind of enjoyment, that part of you that actually loves suffering, peeks out.
Yeah.
It's given permission. You're given permission to admit that you actually enjoy it.
And so the same would
be. Or at least.
Go ahead.
At least potentially recognize that you enjoy it.
And so the same would be true for worrying then, right? That even though I know people who worry, they don't talk about their worry as much. It's just always there. But like I, you know, like the story I had a story of a person who was a stalker. And I, on the one hand, I was afraid of my stalker and I wanted him to go away. Yeah. And on the other hand, I was always telling people about the last thing that he did. And
yeah,
it was right. It was a very dramatic story. And at one point I caught that and I stopped, you know, I stopped. But, I know people who worry and they don't necessarily talk about their worrying all the time in the way that I was telling that story. So, so how would they find the part of them that love the worry energy, do you think?
You know, it's funny how when it's more intense, just like my experience when my wife left me, you know, when it gets more intense, sometimes then it's easier to see the truth of the nature of the mind, the nature of feelings, the nature of desires, you know. When they're more subtle or chronic or just kind of ongoing, that kind of thing, then it takes a little bit more active curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, just to really get curious. What is it like, actually like when I worry? What are the sensations in my body? Are they actually bad sensations or just very particular sensations? Especially if I get a really good worry going, you know, where like my palms get sweaty and my heart is beating fast, you know. It's like I'm just sitting here, you know, in this room by myself and I'm having all these physiological reactions to my worries, you know.
Yeah.
And if you anything that can get you to be very present to the whole experience, that curiosity is the best stuff, you know. It like just being curious about that wow, that's really amazing that I can generate so much sensation, so much response physiologically to pictures in my own mind.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you're that close to the experience, to the reality of your worrying that you're experiencing right now, that's when you might catch also, you know, some part of you that enjoys it, some part of you that, you know, it makes you feel more comfortable if you're worrying than if you're not worrying, something like that.
Yeah, I would imagine.
You know, the enjoyment might be subtle also.
Yeah,
know?
I would imagine that there's a thought that somehow if I worry enough, I'll be safe, that must be in there, that could be seen.
Yeah. And again, you probably really enjoy that thought.
Yes.
Enjoy, it's like Linus with his blankie, you know, with his little blanket, you know, and you just think, oh, you know, only I'm going to be safe because I'm worried. You know?
Yeah. Now, what do you have in your hand? What do you have in your hand? I noticed you raised something like this,
yeah.
Maybe.
tiny little mala.
I have mine's actually a rosary, but I do like holding the beads sometimes. I noticed you were holding beads. In addition to what we've been talking about, you know, you talked about your experience by the river, and of course since then I'm certain there's been some type of a maturing or expanding, and I know that you also had some type of a relationship with Adyashanti, right?
Yes.
So could you talk a little bit about your experience of maturing, if there were other obstacles that you had to get over, what that experience was like? What was your whole experience, just kind of generally?
You know, I just love, I've always been intensely curious. You know, I think that curiosity is almost like a fundamental quality of awareness. That as awareness flows more freely, it gets more and more curious about everything. And so, you know, as beautiful, as profound as that experience by the river was, as beautiful, as profound as all the experiences I've had, I'm just intensely curious about what's here, what's going on, you know. And so rather than move away if I encounter some remaining piece of, you know, fear or worry or attachment or desire,
yes.
You know, I get really excited and go exploring. And so when I met, it's kind of similar to what I said about meeting Neelam. When I met Adyashanti, it was clear that there was something there, you know, that was beyond what I had discovered. And yes. So I didn't, in that case, I didn't drop everything. I just started going to a lot of his satsangs and retreats and stuff. Until it's funny, and you know, it was a beautiful discovery, exploration. He's such a wonderful, clear, explorer himself, you know, and such a good explainer of these things. And so I kept going to events with him until I went to this long retreat with him. And I actually told him this because at that time he still did Dokusan, where he would talk to people individually, you know. And so in my Dokusan, this was most of the way through the retreat, I said to Ajah, you know, Ajah, this retreat has like been totally easy, right? You know, and it's like it's been like a nice little vacation, you know. And I said, you know, I think maybe that means I don't need to come anymore. unless I want to have a vacation, I could come back. And he agreed. He said, yeah, you know, if it's that sort of easeful for you to be here, then you don't really need to come back. And so I never went back to another retreat. But I've explored all kinds of stuff since. I actually was a student of the Diamond Approach for 10 years. I often would say to other people, you know, people would ask me about the Diamond Approach and what's that like compared to Advaita and the whole satsang kind of thing. And I would always say I was really, really glad that I came across Nilam and kind of the satsang direct, you know, very direct kind of pointing, direct experiential path. Before I encountered the Diamond Approach.
And what is the Diamond Approach?
Oh, so it was developed by this man, Hamid Ali. His pen name is Almas. He's written many books, and he has a whole school with a lot of teachers that he's taught. And it's a very incredibly thorough and deep map of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, all the, you know, there's this very, you know, contracted human personality, there's this immense, limitless, absolute reality, but there are so many realities in between. And the Diamond Approach has mapped out so much of what's present in consciousness, what's possible in consciousness, all these different dimensions and different flavors of essence and being, and, you know, and the reason I would always say that I was glad I came across satsang first is that for me, it was like just this incredible hobby, this incredible thing to explore, to dive in, to, you know, uncover anything. The Diamond Approach is also very psychological. It draws on a lot of very deep understandings of the psychology of the ego.
Yes.
And so, you know, the processes and exercises and the group discussions, we would always be diving into all this kind of stuff, exploring every nook and cranny of consciousness. But I never felt like I was trying to get somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Just
and I would look, yeah, I was just, you know, more like a tourist.
Yeah.
than, you know, having somewhere I had to be at a certain time or before I got done.
Yeah, so but more uncovering what's happening? Is that what
you're
saying?
Yeah. Oh yeah, endless. Yeah.
But in an at ease sort of way instead of in a drastic searching sort of way.
Yeah, it was just so much less driven.
Yes.
Know? And especially if I compassionately would look around at the other people in the group, and some of them I could tell they were trying so hard to get somewhere with the Diamond Approach.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's just where they were at.
I understand.
But, yeah.
Yeah, well, people who still believe they're suffering, they have to work very, very hard to try and find happiness. But if you're happy,
sure.
If you're happy, then you can just be with whatever is coming now. So
right.
It's a completely different perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
And it hasn't stopped for me. I just continue to explore, continue to discover. I'm not sure You know, I always loved that guy, David Hawkins. He had the scale of consciousness, and I loved how on his scale of consciousness, enlightenment was only 600 out of 1,000.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, there's a whole bunch of stuff after enlightenment, you know? So it's like, don't, you know.
So you're not one of those people then that would say, I'm done.
I hope not. That would get old really fast, you know? And my sense is that even within my own experiences, that when you are, to whatever degree you are done, then you become very attractive to people who want what you have. Hmm. And so you're not really done. You're just working with these apparent other conscious
right.
beings, you know. So it, you know, but however far you get, you're, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, it's still, it'd be possible to just, you know, expand your way right out of the human dimension. But, you know, that hasn't happened to me yet. And
right.
So in the meantime, I don't feel a pull to be done. I just love exploring what does appear.
Yeah. One thing I feel like I hear from you, which, is very refreshing, is that there's this sense that everything's just kind of natural. And then being at ease with whatever is now without thinking I should be somewhere different than I am or having different experiences than I'm having, which I think
yeah.
causes a lot of suffering and stress for people.
Yeah, so, you know, it's so suffering, remember I said it's a mirage, but
yes.
that strangely enough, that makes it really easy to suffer over the most silly things or, you know, suffer over the fact that you're suffering, you know, and then suffer over the fact that you're suffering over the fact that you're suffering, you know, suffer over all your spiritual experiences and all your, and the lack of spiritual experiences.
Yes.
It's like, you know, suffering is cheap, you know, you can buy a ticket to the suffering game for nothing. You know, they just give them away outside the door. everybody gets in that wants to play that game. So, you know, suffering can sneak back in at any level. Identity can sneak back in. But my sense of the place of identity in consciousness is, see, to me, the ideal is a total flexibility of identity.
Okay, tell me what you mean by that.
You know, a lot of people, when they hear about these more expanded states of being and consciousness, they turn that into the goal, and they want to get there and stay there. They want to get stuck in expansion.
Yes.
And my it's just like an observation that it seems like what consciousness likes to do is it likes to try it every which way. You know, it's like it enjoys all experience. It enjoys all the ability to fully identify with this body, with this mind, with an image in your head, you know, a child, the inner child, which is just an image in your head, in your mind. And probably ultimately with anything, you can move your identity into physical objects, into other beings. And that's just different. It's smaller, yeah, but it, you know, bigger is not necessarily better. Bigger is just different. And so to me, the ultimate is when your consciousness can, you know, put on identities like you put on clothes,
mm-hmm.
where you have this total flexibility to change at any moment, try on any size, shape, form of identity, and also it includes the ability to disidentify, to, you know, go into a more expansive, less identified state. But it also, to me, includes the ability to identify. And the funny thing about that definition of the ultimate is kind of like that my realization by the river, it includes everything that's happened so far for everybody. that is consciousness exploring its limitless abilities to identify. So it includes everything up to now. There is nothing left out of that definition of freedom. Freedom isn't somewhere you get. Freedom is what you've been doing all along.
Yeah.
I sometimes joke that consciousness is too damn free, you know? So damn free, it's been free to suffer.
Free to suffer, yes.
Free to get, you know, people talk about getting stuck, and of course it can feel like you're stuck, you know, but no one's ever gotten stuck. I mean, ultimately, you know, no matter how stuck you are in a particular identity, you know, eventually you die, and you get pretty damn unstuck at that point. And then you get stuck in the next body that you incarnate as, but eventually you get unstuck again, you know. So no one has ever successfully gotten stuck anywhere. You know, if they did, they'd be the first one in history to actually be stuck.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was looking at some of your free ebooks online just to get to know you a little bit. And let me see. I'm not good at remembering names, so let me click over here real quick and see which book I was looking at. Oh, yeah, Living from the Heart.
Yeah.
One thing that I really enjoyed about looking at that book, and I just flipped through it. I haven't, like, sat and read it. I flip through and read a little bit and then flip through and read a little more. But all of the exercises I found very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, because, as you know, there's lots of things to read, and reading can become sometimes purely intellectual.
Sure.
And I thought your exercises were very interesting. And I looked at the exercise about seeing through the heart instead of through the head. And that was actually very natural for me. At some point there was a shift for me where the seeing through the heart happens anyway. So that was easy. But where I found myself actually trying, and then I just quit trying, is when you were talking about seeing through the belly.
Yes, yeah.
That wasn't as natural.
Whole channel down there.
Yeah, that wasn't as natural for me. But I thought maybe for people listening, it might be fun if you guide a little bit in the seeing through the heart exercise. And if you want to, you can go to the belly exercise, whatever you feel. But I thought it might be nice to try something experiential.
Yeah, so if everybody just, it doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be complicated. If you just find an object that you're aware of, you know, probably, I think for the purposes of this exercise, we'll do it with the eyes open. And just notice an object in the room. You know, probably best to pick something fairly neutral, like a lamp or a lampshade or an object that's just present that you have very, you know, relatively neutral feelings about. And just look at it, notice it, give it attention, and notice where that attention is coming from. And for most people, it initially will be a sense of something behind the eyes, a sense of it being in your head. And you're just noticing the object. I'll say lamp for Melorn. So you're noticing the lamp, but whatever object. You're noticing that object from your head. And that's just, you know, you can just notice what that whole experience is like. And then very simply, without, again, any making it into anything special, just drop the place that you're noticing the lamp or the object from down into your heart. If you can't do that with your eyes open, sometimes it's easier at first. You can close your eyes and just sense the presence of the object, like that the object is still there. You can sense that from your heart. And don't worry about doing it right or what it's supposed to feel like or anything like that. Just allow as much as you can to sense that object from down here in the heart. And notice how that is different than when you were up in your head. ask whether there's any difference in how connected you feel to the object, how important any thoughts that you're having. I mean, if you're down here in your heart and there are thoughts up there in your head about the lamp or about this whole exercise, but if you rest down here in the heart, how important are those thoughts? Are they more important or are they less important? And also notice anything you can sense or experience about the lamp or object that's different from down here in the heart. How is the experience of the lamp different? And you can even do this with the eyes open. It's just you drop the seeing down into the heart. So how is that for you, Regina?
Well, for me, it was very nice. I like dropping into the heart. And in fact, I would say, you know, it's something I do regularly. I started to use the word practice, but I don't know if it's a practice as much as it's natural. If I just notice I've gravitated to the head, I drop to the heart. And
yeah.
I'm more comfortable and more at ease in the heart, naturally.
Yeah.
So I like hanging out there.
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, my parents made me take piano lessons, and I hated practicing. You know, and then finally they let me quit taking lessons. And then I found out that I actually liked playing the piano.
Yeah, play is a good word instead of practice. Play is a very good word.
Yeah.
I was telling, when I was on the hour before you, and I was telling people that I went today to see the movie American Sniper. And for the last couple of weeks, my attention has been on war a lot because of things that have happened in the news, and then going to see American Sniper. And what I found was very interesting for me, what has been watching war from the heart.
Yes.
Yeah, that's been very, very interesting to me. And of course, it's a completely different experience than watching war from the head.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
So that could be a place where it could be really valuable to explore, to play with, dropping into your belly.
Okay, talk to me more about that, because that I did not really get from the reading, so maybe you could talk me through dropping to the belly.
Yeah, so that same, just go back to that same object.
Okay.
And again, notice just naturally where your attention is flowing from to start with. You know, it may have moved back up into the head, which is fine. It might be down in the heart. It might be a little in both. And just take that in. Notice what that's like, what the object is like from there. And then just, it's mostly like just allow it. Allow the awareness of the object to sink down into the lower abdomen. Just experience it from there. Again, at first, it's often easier to do that with the eyes closed because the eyes are up in the head. So you can just feel that presence of that object from your belly.
Hmm.
Doesn't have to be any more complicated than that, any more special, but it will, it's actually a different quality, a different set of qualities than when you experience from the heart. What do you notice when you do that?
The word that I would use to describe what I felt was grounded. There was something very grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It you experience it from that grounded part of your being.
Yes.
From.
Yes.
And that's where our strength and our will and our, you know, our capacity and our, strength is really important in terms of when you're viewing something like war.
Yes.
To be able to be present in that kind of, you know, in the movie. I haven't seen the movie, but, you know, I can imagine some of the scenes are very intense.
Yeah.
If you drop down into your belly, and it doesn't have to be a movie, you know, you can drop down to your belly when your boss is yelling at you, when you're, you know, when you're, you know, afraid or angry or upset, you know, and just experience the situation from your belly.
Yeah. I'm very grateful, right? You know, I always enjoy having that opportunity to have had a perspective that I haven't had before, and that's what just happened, and that was really wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. And you can, again, just play, you know, because you'll find every experience is different depending on where you experience it from, you know, whether it's eating or making love or having an argument or, you know, going out to exercise. You know, you can try all the different places and find out what you know, kind of fits that activity. Or you can just play and not settle on any one, you know, and just do it different every time. You can also, awareness isn't really located anywhere. Awareness, or you could say awareness is everywhere. So it can actually flow from anywhere. It can flow from 3 feet behind your head. It can flow from up above you. It can, you know, flow from your head, your heart, and your belly all at the same time. And another fun one is to allow awareness to flow from nowhere or everywhere. And then, you know, it has, again, the lamp has a totally different experience when it's experienced from everywhere. Or from emptiness, whatever, you know, whatever words you want to play with, whatever, you know, place you want to experience from, you can.
Yeah, I like your emphasis on play and curiosity. I think that would make this a lot easier for some people. I think, you know, I don't have a problem with the word practice. In fact, when I use the word practice, I think that I'm always very playful. I think I am very playful, naturally.
Okay, yeah.
So I don't have a problem with the word practice. But I know that some people, when they hear about spiritual practice, there's such an efforting, you know, such a tight efforting, and the practice itself becomes a burden. And then, of course, there's always that judgmental mind telling them they're not doing it right, they'll never be good enough. Yeah.
When someone asks for advice about meditation, you know, I'll often say to them that the only measure of a good meditation is whether or not your butt is still on the cushion at the end when the timer goes off. And if it is, then you had some kind of experience, whether it was one of struggle or one of falling asleep half the time or one of your mind wandering or it was one of, you know, some cosmic experience. Those are all equally valuable if you actually, you know, spent that time on the cushion or the chair, whatever, you know, it doesn't have to be a cushion.
And what do you think makes, sitting on a cushion or a chair for, let's say a person decides they're going to do this for an hour and staying for the whole hour, what is the benefit to that?
You know, it's, my experience is that every time I do it, it's different. And I've come to enjoy that richness, enjoy that discovery again, that you know, and there are times when it is, especially, you know, it's only recently actually in my life that I've been doing longer meditations. In just the last few months, I've been doing 90-minute and longer meditations. And it's like, oh! That's different too, you know. It's like, you know, it's not just like, oh my God, this is taking forever. You know, of course that happens sometimes. You know, where it's like, oh my God, it's only been 40 minutes, and I'm supposed to set the timer for 90. What was I thinking? But other times it's like, something else happens. You know, when you, it's like, I think what, you know, part of what happens. Sometimes, again, it's different every time, but sometimes what's happened is my mind completely checked out because it was hopeless. I couldn't, you know, to think about how much longer is the meditation. And so there wasn't any thought of when is this going to be over. I totally gave up because it was so far in the future that I forgot about it, you know. Mm. It was so, you know, 90 minutes is, it's funny when you're sitting there doing nothing, how long 90 minutes is. And so at some point that whole, you know, actually very early on, sometimes the whole question of how long is this going to last doesn't, it just doesn't compute. It'd be like, you know, it'd be like, you know, wondering, well, gee, I wonder how much longer I have to keep breathing. God, so I've been breathing for years, and it's like, how much longer do I have to? No, you don't even think about it. You just like, you're just going to be breathing until you're not, you know? And so I don't know if that's part of what the longer, setting the timer for even longer times. It just seems to unlock another possibility in that experience that I just had never explored before.
Yeah, I never really, I've always been a contemplator rather than a meditator up until the last few months. In the last few months, I still contemplate. I actually get up and I contemplate first, but then at some point I feel the contemplation feels to stop doing that, like to be even less heady than that, even though it's really very heart-like. It starts feeling a little heady at some point, and then I put it aside and I just sit. And and I find just sitting to be very, very sweet right now, which is something I've never done. I don't sit with my eyes closed usually. Sometimes they close, but I might be looking out the window, or I have lots of devotional symbols, and I might just be looking at a devotional symbol. But really, I'm just sitting, and I find it to be very, very sweet. But what has amazed me, which you've kind of touched on, is how much goes on when you're doing nothing.
Yes.
There's a lot going on. And like you said, every day is a different experience.
Right. And also not just, you know, obviously, you know, the mind, you know, there are times when the mind can get very busy, when you, especially, strangely enough, when you sit to supposedly be quiet, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's so much else going on.
Yes.
And so much else. There's so many dimensions to this reality, this truth. There's so many subtle energies, subtle dimensions, subtle aspects, you know, awareness itself is a total mystery. And it's here, it's happening. You know, I often ask people in my work with them or in satsang, I say, are you aware of anything? And I've been doing this for almost 20 years and I yet have had anybody say no.
Yeah.
So there's like always this great big mystery, no matter how bored you are, no matter how sleepy, no matter how, it's like this great big mystery. What is it that notices that you're bored? And that's, you know, that strangely you can get very curious and fascinated about boredom itself.
Yeah, well, that's one thing I've discovered happens in sitting is that I find myself, I would say, interested in things that before I would not have noticed, you know. Even interested in, like, the ringing in my ears. I'll sit and I'll listen to the ringing in my ears because normally I would not have noticed the ringing in my ears. So, you know, very, very subtle things I can get very, very interested in and spend a lot of time looking at it, playing with it.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's also fine to have, you know, you said just sit, but you know, it's also, you know, again, you can play with it, and it's also fine to set, I think, a more, like, gentle, subtle direction to, you know, rather than, like, trying to open your third eye or something, you know, something that requires a lot of effort, but just, you know, directing attention to awareness itself.
Yes, I definitely, yes.
Or, you know, to get started, you know, direct it to something like the breath or things like that. So, you know, a nice, gentle, soft directionality to the meditation just to get things rolling.
Yes.
For people, especially for people that are kind of new to it. That's really helpful.
Now, what about people who don't understand what you mean when you say direct attention to awareness?
Well, it's that's actually, you know, that's a subtle kind of directing. You know, like I said, if you're first starting out, probably better to start with the breath. Or my wife meditated, and still does sometimes, she meditated for decades listening to music. Mm. But it wasn't just, you know, I don't know, she really made it into a meditation. She really gave her full attention to the music.
Yes.
And so once you're in the mode of giving a lot of attention to something and being able to, you know, gently bring your attention back to the breath or back to the music whenever you notice that it's not there, you know, you're paying attention to something else, usually a thought or a sensation or a, you know, something has taken you away from that thing you set the intention to pay attention to. You gently bring your attention back. Now to direct that to awareness itself is, how to put it? It's like, it's a paradoxical use of your mind because you're directing attention to a place it can't go. But what it can, where it can go is like to the boundary. To, you know, it can go, it's almost like going towards a black hole where you get to a certain point and then, you know, you can't see anymore because it's inside the black hole. And so when you direct attention to awareness itself, you come to this place where you can't see, where you can't feel, where you can't think, where you can't penetrate with your awareness back into itself. But you can keep bringing your attention right there to that strange, mysterious, like, space or emptiness or whatever. You know, there's all kinds of subtle qualities that you can discover about awareness when you're doing this, because right at that surface is where the most subtle qualities of your awareness, of your being, are the most obvious. So you can discover that it's, even though you have no clue what it is, it's incredibly alive. It is incredibly empty or spacious. And that's not, you still haven't penetrated it. But if you're experiencing that spaciousness, you're right at that boundary. If you're experiencing something that's just fundamentally alive, you're right at that boundary. And if you hang out there, you spend a lot of time there, every now and then you get sucked into the black hole. And something, and it's like a whole nother dimension of, I don't have words for it. I want to say experience, but it's not an experience. it's a non-experience. It's like whatever you imagine experiencing, you just take that away too. Because there's not even that. There's not even the experience of nothing. And so every now and then you know, when you're hanging out right there at that boundary, it's like, it'd be like, you know, taking your sleeping bag down and sleeping 2 feet away from where the waves are rolling up. You know, odds are that, you know, sometime during the night, a big wave is going to come and take you.
Yeah, so you're hanging out at Grace's door, just waiting for Grace to come and get you.
Yeah.
Making yourself available.
Right, and sometimes you only know anything like that, like what I'm describing, has, again, happened because all of a sudden you come back and you go, huh, where was I? What was that? You know, it's like like the timer goes off after 90 minutes and there was no experience of time.
Right.
So, that's still, remember what I said earlier, that's still not the goal. It's just one more, actually very profound dimension of being.
Yeah, because you don't want people, again, judging themselves for not having a particular experience. You know, it seems like it's best if people can just be happy with what is right now, whatever that is.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other thing you can be sure of with meditation is that if you did have some, like, really unique and amazing experience yesterday, then you're almost like guaranteed not to have anything even close to that today or for the next 3 weeks. You know, it's like, it's like there's something about any kind of, again, there's such a subtle difference between setting a gentle intention versus having an expectation or a goal in mind.
Yeah.
A subtle intention, just a subtle way of directing attention, But I would say it's somewhere in between passive and active. You know, because trying to make anything happen is being too active. And it's, you know, it's possible to get into kind of a lethargic, Sanskrit they would call it tamasic kind of state of where you're just, you know, you maybe just fall asleep.
Yeah.
Something like that. And that's, you know, again, nothing wrong. There's no mistake. You can learn from that experience also. But it's right. Like, there's also this like place in between where you're not pushing, pulling, but you are sensing, you are noticing.
You feel the difference. I mean, I mentioned that up until recently, I had never been one to meditate, and that's why I always try closing my eyes to meditate. And one thing I've been very, very good at my entire life is falling asleep. When I go to bed at night, I don't even hardly remember going to bed. I mean, I lay down, close my eyes, and boom, I'm gone. So
yeah.
When I would meditate with my eyes closed, it would only take maybe 10, 15 minutes, and the little dream characters would start coming in, and I would go to sleep. So what I started noticing is that sometimes I would just have this feeling to sit. It would just come upon me. And if I would just sit with my eyes open, it was always a very pleasant experience of some type.
Yes.
Even if something was going on in the mind that I was watching, there was still a pleasantness about it. And
right.
And so I decided at one point, you know what, I'm not going to meditate like everyone says.
Yeah,
I'm going to
yeah.
meditate the way that feels right for me. And so I call it meditation or I call it sitting. But I almost always have my eyes open. I very, very seldom close my eyes. And I can sit for fairly long periods of time that way, and it feels right. I don't know how else to say that. It feels very right, where the falling asleep did not feel as right, even though it happened.
Well, it's great if you need some more sleep. But
which I didn't.
it's just sleep, you know.
Yeah,
exactly. It just is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it might actually reassure you and also be something for you to play with. But in the Diamond Approach, they would talk about having your eyes half open.
Yeah.
I think it just depends on your nature. Someone like you that falls asleep so easily, to find that place in between.
Yes.
You need to stay a little bit more. You know, you have to err a little bit on the active side.
Well, and also. I have, like I told you, I have devotional symbols, but I also have
yeah.
this lovely screen, which you can't see, but it's like a screen that you can pull shut, and it's covered with just pictures of windows from Italy, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I can just sit and look at one of those windows on that screen, and so it's not a real active eyes
yeah,
being open thing, right?
But it's still more active than closing.
It's still more active than closing my eyes, right? I'm looking
yeah.
at a window on a screen and then just sitting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, you might also, you know, experiment with your eyes half open, so
okay.
there's not, so you're not really, you can't really see anything.
Yeah.
But not where your eyes are closed. So you know, it's like you just have a little blur
yeah.
of an image in your eyes.
Yeah.
Just experiment.
Just well, I love playing, so I'm happy to do that.
Yeah. Whereas you know, someone who, you know, has a naturally much more active nature, that you know, they probably should turn off all the lights. Put on a blindfold, put in earplugs.
Right,
you know,
to cut out all the distractions.
Just, you know, keep as, you know, do as much as they can to withdraw from all of that stuff so that they can find that place that's in between.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I just want to say, because we're down at 8 minutes after, we only go until the half hour, and if anybody wants to ask any questions or anything, please put up your hand. I would be very, very happy to turn the mic over. I've actually been spending a little more time with you than I typically do. Often my eyes are in the room a lot, and for some reason my eyes are with you. So I almost forgot that there was anybody here besides the two of us. But I'm really enjoying speaking with you. So it's been a nice conversation. But it isn't supposed to be just the two of us. So if anybody else wants to, please put your hand up. And right now they're all being quiet, so maybe they're just enjoying what we're talking about as well. I think it is refreshing for people to hear that that this process can have a naturalness to it. I think people like that rather than the efforting. Although, as you've mentioned, there has to be, it's kind of like, I think Adyashanti calls it effortless effort. There has to be some effort. It can't be as you said, tamasic. You can't be where there's, you know, there's just nothing, that you're not putting any attention at all.
Right.
But at the same time, it shouldn't be the struggle. It's finding that place in between.
Right. And another thing, just to reassure people, anytime you are pushing the envelope, anytime you're stretching or trying something new, or then there's just naturally going to be a little bit more sense of effort.
Yes.
You know? So if you've never meditated before, then meditating is going to be more of an effort at first. You know, it's like anything. You know, when you first learn to drive a car, it was much more effortful than it is now.
Or if you've never let yourself feel your emotions, because a lot of people, of course, as you know, run from these emotions that are perceived as negative. And if you've never allowed yourself to relax and sink into the emotions, there's some effort in staying there, because your natural tendency is to run in some way.
Yeah. And yet, even then, you know, it's good to hold it lightly, to you know, use the minimum amount of effort you can to actually do what you set as your intention. Mm-hmm. And find out what that is, because there's a lot of, you know, unnecessary effort actually gets in the way, just like it does in driving, or it does in having a conversation, or it does in anything. And you know, in the non-dual tradition, there's this whole pointing to a certain, you know, depth, a very deep part of the place in reality where there is no doer.
Yes.
And that, you know, that sometimes gets interpreted. It's almost like the mind is trying to imitate that by having there be no doing. You know, no one said there's no doing. You know, they said there's no doer. And so they try to experience no doer by experiencing no doing, you know, by rejecting any kind of doing, or any, which is silly, because not doing something often takes a lot of effort.
Yeah.
To not do something, it can be as more effortful than to do it. So, you know, that's why I speak about it, is this, you know, this it playing with the amount of effort, playing on the edge, finding out how little effort, and being willing to put in more effort at first.
I remember, you know, when you were telling us your story, you said this wasn't important, but that you left your school and all of these types of things. And when I started this path about a year into it, I felt very much to leave my job. And and I experienced a lot of fear around that. And it was very difficult for me to do nothing, because my mind was telling me to run and get the paper, look for another job, send out resumes. But I knew in my heart that isn't what I was to do. This wasn't a head thing. I knew in my heart I wasn't to. But it took a lot of effort to do nothing.
To stay with your truth.
Stay with my truth, to stay with my heart. And then at some point that became very easy. You know, now it's very easy to follow the heart. But there was an effort to get out of all of those old beliefs. You know, I was raised in Kansas. You work hard and make money, and that's what life's about, right?
Right.
So so it was hard to let go of that value system and then just live by following the heart.
Yeah. And that was a very elegant use of effort.
You know,
very appropriate use of effort.
Yes. But it was hard.
Yeah.
And it was also hard because there were so many voices telling me I was crazy. So that was also harder, that the doubt, the self-doubt. But again, the heart was very sure, so I just had to keep checking in.
Yeah. There's a, just since you mentioned it, you know, there's a thing you can do with the voice, that, especially the voice in your head, the critical voice.
Yes.
The voice that tells you you're bad or wrong, or, you know, what you should do, that kind of thing. It's so contrary to the usual kind of spiritual techniques or practices where you embrace and allow and accept. This is kind of, again, a place where effort is helpful. And what you can do is just tell that voice to shut up.
Yeah.
Go jump in a lake. Just don't back down.
Yeah.
Just interrupt it. Don't let it get the work in as well. And what's happening when you do that is that you actually are embracing the gift. it's this big, powerful, judgmental adult kind of voice inside your head. And you're stepping up to the plate and being equal to it.
Yeah.
And that actually collapses the projection, brings that, it's called the superego, you know, brings the power, the strength that has been projected onto the superego back into yourself. And then a strange thing happens is that the ego and the superego, this is one of the things in the Diamond Approach, because they drew on all this kind of depth psychology, that those two things actually form together. They arise at the same time in our development. The ability to hold an image of mom or dad, authority, and the ability, you have to at the same time then form an image of yourself, which is the ego. And so anytime you actually stand up to your superego, tell it to shut up and mean it and don't back down and you get it to shut up, it's a strange thing. It's like suddenly no one's there, not even you, not even that egoic sense of self. It's very quiet, very simple. So that's just a little.
Yeah.
Another thing to play with.
Yeah, what I did was I would, I told you I've always been a contemplator, so in the morning there would be some thought that would be very inspirational. I would keep it on a piece of paper, and during the day when the critical voice would come, I would just shift my attention to the thought. I just continually shifted my attention away until at some point that voice doesn't really have an effect for me anymore. Every now and then it might still say something, but I don't pay any attention to it, and it certainly doesn't talk to the degree that it used to. I mean, it really doesn't even bother showing up very much anymore.
Yeah, the inner critic can and will subside if you I mean, you just withdrew your attention from
it. That's exactly. I'd shift my attention to something else.
I just, you know, it's fun to have one place where you can be like a samurai warrior and go to battle. And the one place you can do that that's actually productive is to go to battle with your superego.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing, is you just can't keep believing it. If you keep believing it, it's just going to hurt you.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, you know, when the superego formed, it was formed for a valid, useful purpose. You know, it allowed us as little kids to hold the image of mom even when she wasn't present. And that was like the best we could do as a way to basically manage ourselves, you know, control ourselves.
Stay safe, maybe.
Not get in as much trouble, you know, because we already heard mom yelling at us before she was even came into the room, you know, so we just stopped and didn't do that, or, you know. And so it was natural, normal, healthy, functional development. And just like, you know, you don't still wear the clothes you wore when you were 2 years old. You don't need that same sort of crutch. You don't even need the ego that again forms at the same time. You don't need to live your life through images in your head. You can either direct your attention away from them, or if that, you know, sometimes some people's superegos are really strong. And so if you meet fire with fire. You know,
well, I think my superego, as you're calling it, was very strong. I just think that I was actually very strong in shifting my attention away. It was a very committed. So I feel like, you know, maybe I'm being a little sexist here, but I feel like you're talking about the male approach and I went the female approach.
Yeah. And some people, you know, it's fun to uncover, you know, it might be fun for you to uncover your male, your inner samurai warrior. And whatever works, you know, if you can do it just by withdrawing attention, it's like, why get out the heavy artillery if a little, you know, water pistol will do the trick? You
know? Yeah. Well, let's see. What have we have about 12 minutes left. What have we not talked about that might be useful for the next 12 minutes?
I spoke about it earlier. There's kind of like two aspects to the spiritual unfolding. You know, one is the increasing discovery of who and what is here. You know, what is awareness? What's actually present? You know, just uncovering more and more of that. And then the other is the undoing of the stuff that either gets in the way or just makes you so miserable that you can't really pay attention to what's here. And that, you know, we mentioned that that's the suffering. And so, you know, if that's, I don't know if that's useful for people to recognize there's these two different aspects that interact with each other, but they don't necessarily move in unison. And so I've known people that have had very profound realizations about their nature, but the habit of suffering is so strong that it just, like we talked about it a little bit, you know, about you can suffer over your spiritual progress. You can suffer over, you know, it's like that little subtle thing of resisting or questioning or doubting or, can still be present even after there's been some very strong realizations. And so at that point it's important to inquire not just into who am I, but inquire into the nature of suffering.
Yeah.
Into what is that? How do I suffer, and what is it really? Is it, how real is it? And you know, even what I said, you know, about it, is that a bad sensation? It's like, is suffering actually a bad experience? Or is it just a certain way of, it's like an over-efforting. That's all. You know, it's just a little push-pull that's happening in your being, or a lot push-pull. You know, if the shit is really hitting the fan, you might be suffering a lot. You know, so it's amazing how people can suffer a lot when there's nothing really bad happening.
Yes. I've had that experience.
It's always a question of how hard you're pushing or pulling.
Yeah.
So you can, like I said, it's this paradoxical thing where you go into it. You find out about the nature of suffering. Because the opposite is actually true. I've met people that have undone their suffering, but they never thought to question, who am I? You know, they never really were that curious about that. They just wanted to get rid of that damn suffering, you know. And so they very methodically or, you know, found some process where they could unravel it, at least enough that it becomes this kind of loose thing.
They can relax.
You can step in and out. It's like it never really grabs you, or rarely grabs you. And so I've met people that are not suffering very much, but they haven't had any kind of profound realization of their true nature.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's a wonderful, you know, it's just an opportunity here to balance those, to flesh it out, to fill in whatever is the gap in our experience. And, you know, doesn't take a lot to figure out if you are suffering. I think a good default is to always just go straight to presence, to being, to awareness, to, you know, being curious about that. And if you just can't get there because you're just too upset about da 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 da, or, you know, there's too much, tension in your body or some kind of unconscious resistance, well then, you know, go to plan B, which is to explore your suffering. Explore the nature of that. And once that's loosened up, you can maybe drop back into exploring presence, going more directly.
Yeah, so looking, exploring instead of believing is what I'm hearing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad that you came back to that, because that was one of the first things you said, and we've been talking for about 90 minutes, so it's nice to bring that back. Because, of course, if someone is suffering, what the mind wants them to forget, it seems like, is how to not suffer. Forget that you can look. Forget that you can be curious. Forget that you can ask, what is this sensation and where is my suffering coming from?
And what is it even? You know, is it even, like I said, is it even really a bad experience? Or is it just a certain flavor, a certain quality of experience that's not really, it's so strange. Like I said, it's like a mirage. When you get up close to it, you know, that mirage when you're riding on the highway in the summer and it looks like there's water on the highway.
Yes.
And then when you get to that spot, there's no mirage, there's no water. So if you go towards your suffering, you find out, oh, it's just, you know, it's just some images in my head, or it's just a sensation in my body that if I stop and actually experience the sensation, there's no suffering in the sensation. You go looking for the suffering, and the antidote to suffering is to go looking for the actual reality of the suffering right now, and then you can't find it. It's like the cure is to find out, oh, you know, whatever I thought I was suffering over, that wasn't really suffering. It was a trick of the mind. It was a optical illusion, emotional illusion of a perception that created this trick, this, you know, interesting little play called suffering.
Let's see, I'm going to check and see if anybody... Okay, I think I do have a question here. Let's see. Someone says, I don't get it. Am I supposed to ignore thought or accept it?
Like I said, if you can go straight to presence, if you can go to some place other than thought, then that's great. And if that's just not happening, then you can actually become really curious about, just like I said, curious about suffering, you know, and suffering actually is just thought. You know, that's the optical illusion. It's a mental illusion, you know, a thought-generated experience. But if you can't go to presence, then you can get curious about thought. What is thought? Where does it come from? How do you know right now even that you are thinking? How do you know what you're thinking? Where do thoughts go when they stop?
That's an excellent question. Where do they come from and where do they go?
Yeah. And then you can discover that thought is just thought. You can find out that there's, it doesn't have to go away, doesn't have to change. You discover what it is, and you realize, oh, it's just the thought. Then, if you know, it may naturally subside. It may or it may not. It doesn't. To me, the biggest freedom isn't freedom from thought or freedom from suffering or freedom from any kind of experience. The biggest freedom is when it doesn't matter at all what you are experiencing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Then you have complete freedom in thought. You have complete freedom in suffering. You have complete freedom in sadness, in fear, in anger. It's like you're free, even though that's what's happening.
Yeah, I agree with that. Because to be conditionally free means at some point you can be unfree again.
Yeah. If it's freedom from thought, you still have to kind of keep an eye over your shoulder in case it tries to sneak back in, you know?
Yeah.
But if you're totally okay with thought, then you're free as it comes and goes, while it's here, while it's gone.
Yeah, let me see. Okay, I don't know if the person who asked this question is someone I actually don't know. Usually I know nearly everyone in the room, but I don't know this person. The person is using a name, AUB8. And AUB8, I don't know if your question is answered or not. Am I supposed to ignore thought or accept it? And I think sometimes everything, it's all a matter of learning the feeling yourself, because, you know, you could on the one hand say ignore the thought, and for someone else ignore may mean repress, and then it's like, no, that's not what we're talking about. So, you know, you have to find the feeling of what we mean when you're saying just say no to a thought. You know, you have to learn what that feels like.
And I would say, actually, in response to the specific wording of that question, I would say try it every which way. Ignore the hell out of your thoughts and see what that's like. You know, accept the hell out of your thoughts and see what that's like. And then also that thing I said, which is inquire, be curious, explore, you know, like chew on, really, not just the content of your thoughts, but the actual experience of thinking, the actual mechanism of thinking.
I think
and then try ignoring them again.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful answer, and it's a wonderful summary, kind of what you've been saying for 90 minutes. You've said so many times, I'm not going to go back and listen to the audio and count, but it would be fun to see how many times you said the word explore.
Yeah.
You know, and that's such a wonderful attitude. If you just, whatever is happening now, whatever is here now, be willing to explore it. Because exploring something is going into it in an open way. It's so much different than being afraid of.
Yeah.
Or judging and resisting. It's a completely different approach to whatever is here.
And then if judging, resisting, anything that fear comes up, guess what?
You can explore that. Exactly.
It's like you don't have to, I always say when you fall off a horse, you don't try and get back on the horse where you fell off. You try and get back on the horse where the horse is now.
Yeah.
And so fear is here now. Then that's here now. That's what you can explore. That's what you can discover.
So there's
you can find out you can be free no matter how afraid you are.
Yeah, so there's no place that's not the starting point for explore. Any place is the starting point.
Yeah.
You don't have to get somewhere first.
In fact, the only starting point is right where you are.
Yeah.
Already, so.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. It's been really nice. I hope that we get to chat again, because it really has been a joy. I found you by you were listed on Ellie Ruzdar's website. That's where I found you.
Huh.
Do you know her?
No.
Well, she doesn't have a lot of teachers listed on her website, and she doesn't even though she is very, very clear, she doesn't think a lot about, teaching. The whole teaching thing just isn't her thing.
Huh.
And so when she has a few teachers listed on her website, I think, oh, so who are these few, when she's not, overly excited about the idea of teaching. And then I saw you there, and I had heard of you before, and I've heard of Gina before. And so I thought, okay, maybe it's time for me to get to know him a little bit. So thank you for saying yes.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure, and I'd happily do it again anytime.
Oh, good, because maybe I'll have you back then. That sounds wonderful. And I will be in touch. I'll send you this audio, so I'll be in touch with you probably tomorrow. How's that sound?
Great.
All right.
Super.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.